at 7 p.m. right here on The Mud.
Support for KMUD programming comes from listeners like you and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, promoting the growth and development of public media in communities throughout America. More information online at cpb.org. This is Redwood Community Radio, KMUD, Garberville, 91.1 FM, KMUE, Eureka, 88.1 FM, KLAI Laytonville 90.3 FM, on the web at kmud.org, and in Shelter Cove 99.5 FM. Support for KMUD comes from the Redwood Coast Energy Authority, offering community energy services since 2003. Programs include low-carbon transportation and electricity supply with a 100% renewable option. Rebates are available for local businesses to upgrade their exterior lighting and other efficiency energy measures. Learn more at redwoodenergy.org, or you can call 707-269-1700. And support for KMUD comes from KEET-TV. KEET invites you to Films, Food, and Conversation, an event Wednesday, February 26th at 6:30 p.m. at the Arcata Playhouse. There is no cost to attend this community event. Watch segments of the PBS series No Passport Required and My Family, My Flavors, shows celebrating local youth chefs. Indulge your palate with a taste from Arcata High's culinary class and participate in a panel discussion with local chefs. Make your reservation at keet.org. Coming up, Ask the Herb Doctor.
Well, welcome to this month's Ask Your Herb Doctor. My name's Andrew Murray.
My name's Sarah Johannesson Murray, and I'm delighted to be back on the show, joining the incredibly knowledgeable Dr. Pete and my wonderful husband.
Okay, so it's February 21st, 2020, the second show this decade. As I mentioned last month, it's a new decade, but we are still able to entreat Dr. Pete to join us on the show to share his wisdom. Last month, very briefly, we were discussing resonant frequencies, the effects on cells of frequencies, and I came across a lot of very interesting abstracts done that were actually 2019 and 2020. So even in the earliest parts of January, there are articles being posted on PubMed, research articles and abstracts related to electromagnetic frequency and extremely low frequency electromagnetic frequencies. Very exciting news, because one of the main studies that caught my eye was a treatment of breast cancer, where they were showing it was absolutely effective. And as an adjunctive therapy to traditional cancer management in breast cancer, I would just like to say that it was part of a adjunctive therapy, not the sole therapy, as the authors wanted to make sure they pointed out too, but that it had very significant cell-killing effects. So last month, like I said, that was the beginning of the show. We opened it up and we got quite a few calls in. So didn't get a chance to get through some of the other very interesting articles on different pathologies that this pulsed EMF was being used to treat. And I know in the past discussions and shows we'd touched a little bit on Rife therapy. We've definitely mentioned vaccines, and I know Dr. Pete's latest newsletter on vaccines in context is something else we'll get to once we get through some of the pathologies related to the abstracts on EMF and its treatment. And then there are some other questions that I have that are part and parcel of people asking questions and wanting to put them to Dr. Pete. So it's a live show, folks, from 7 to 7:30. We basically interview Dr. P, ask him questions, and listen to what he has to say about the mechanisms by which he understands the activity of certain things that we don't normally see as being relevant or being effective, because it's just not the it's not the way things are sometimes, that when a drug comes out, it's given all these different treatment uses, and actually turns out to be fairly negative. So he's got a very different perspective on a lot of things that we would see as just headlines and advertising, and goes certainly into the science of it to show and explain why it's not a good thing. So Dr. Pete, let's introduce you to the show. You here?
Yes. Hi,
Dr. Pete. Okay. So as always, for people who maybe haven't heard your name or know anything about you, we'll definitely at the end of the show give out your web details for people to find more about you. But would you just give an outline of your academic and professional background?
I went from, after graduating from college and getting a master's degree in humanities and studying linguistics for several years, I decided to study brain biology for a PhD. And when I got to the University of Oregon, I quickly decided that brain biology was a dogmatic topic at the time, and I looked around and found reproductive physiology was actually doing empirical science, so that's what I did my dissertation on, reproductive physiology and the changes aging makes in the energy metabolism of the reproductive organs.
Okay, very good. Okay, for people that are listening from 7:30 to 8 p.m., we take callers live on the air. The number, if you live in the area, or even if you don't live in the area, let's just give out the whole number, so no matter where you are, 707-923-3911. So from 7:30 on, callers are invited to call in, 707-923-3911.
And Dr. B, I love the way that you can describe your educational background in a slightly different manner every month. It's just wonderful. Thank you.
So you said that, just very briefly, going back to what you said about developmental biology or reproductive biology, it was empirical based still. So it hadn't been swallowed up by the machine at that point.
The professor, the main professor in female reproduction, Arnold Soderwall, had been working in the field way back in the 40s, and he was one of the early people to test the effects of vitamin E on reproduction. In the 1930s and 40s, it was considered a sex-promoting vitamin, or almost a hormone.
Huh.
And he was one of the people that showed that its effect on increasing fertility took place by being an anti-estrogen. The older an animal got, the earlier it became infertile. He found that increasing the dose of vitamin E steadily with aging, he kept the animals from miscarrying well into old middle age. I continued that research and found that it was partly acting by way of improving the production of progesterone, as well as lowering the effect of estrogen.
Interesting. What were you going to say?
And I also remember you telling me about those flamingos in the African Rift Valley that don't age reproductively because they have so much CO2 from not only the elevation, but from the non-PUFA algae they're eating.
No one is really sure, but I think the high carbon dioxide environment is very likely a big part of it. The usual mortality curve, it's a semi-plateau up until middle age, and then it crashes, and the mortality rate per year for most organisms increases rapidly after a certain age. And with the flamingos, it seems that all through a period of their whole lifespan, the annual mortality continues at just about the same rate by accidents mainly.
Wow.
And that they can breed up until they die from an accident, right?
Apparently, yeah.
Wow. Very, very briefly, when you were doing your PhD, what forms of vitamin E did they know of then? I'm not saying that was so many hundreds of years ago, but 40 years ago or whatever, had they discovered them all? Or
I found a bottle of the very old stuff in the freezer in the lab in 1968 or so. It had been there for decades, and it was a very, very viscous material. And a light amber color. I tested it against some of the quinones, comparing benzoquinone, for example, reacting it with vitamin E and doing a combination, a staining experiment. I got chemical reactions that showed that the sensitivity of the quinone reaction was very vivid in that old sample, and the newer samples, so-called pure vitamin E, I haven't been able to see that same reaction that I got around 1970, using the very old stuff.
Is that anything to do with its antioxidant effects?
No. It was a really a very different kind of reaction.
Was it? Where did they get that vitamin E from? How did they process it?
That was bought from Sigma Chemical Company.
Yeah.
But it was fairly typical at the time. It was very highly refined. It was the highest grade available at the time. But at that time, all vitamin E was fairly brown-colored and very, very thick. And I think some of the studies suggested that it was a waxy, highly saturated, long-chain fatty acid that was part of the endurance promoting antioxidant effect, not the simple tocopherol itself.
So it makes a big difference what form of vitamin E they're using to test and coming up with these results. Does that mean that we need to be careful when we're supplementing with vitamin E?
Yeah, lots of it now. Even 10 or 20 years ago, the majority of it was highly diluted with soybean oil. Highly unsaturated, exactly what my professor found was the antagonistic effect. It protected against the pro-aging effect of the polyunsaturated fats.
So if your vitamin E is thin and liquid, then it's probably not a good vitamin E. If it's thick and viscous, then can we assume that that's a better quality?
I think so.
All right, well, good. That's a little bit of a digression, but very interesting nonetheless, because I was looking at vitamin E just last month and wanting to get some feedback about the best source of vitamin E. Very quickly, do you have any, would you speak to that? What you think is a good, what makes a good quality vitamin E supplement?
I think the mixture of the isotopes, or non-racemic, natural forms, alpha and gamma, are probably the most important, but I think the mixture as it occurs in nature is much better than any of the synthetics. DL-alpha has been sold for a long time because it's cheap to make synthetically.
Okay. So what about, I mean, wheat germ oil is one of the main sources for it, right? But you would not advocate that given...
It's very full of polyunsaturated fat.
Right, right.
I tried some of it in the 1970s, and that caused a choking sensation when you took just a little bit of it.
So you're recommending that you take a mixed tocopherol supplement of vitamin E and not just an isolated D-alpha tocopherol?
In the 1940s, the anti-estrogen quality that was identified from the 1930s, an anti-clotting and anti-estrogen effect was very clearly identified. But with the rise of the estrogen industry starting in 1940, that property, the idea that vitamin E could be very pro-fertility, it was the main fertility vitamin, and at the same time, purely anti-estrogenic. That really put a crimp in the estrogen advertising idea. And they were, I think, a major factor in creating the doctrine that vitamin E's action is as an antioxidant. And the vegetable oil industry at the same time was trying to sell the idea that seed oils are edible, and in feeding them to animals, they were finding that animals became sterile on a high intake of the various seed oils, polyunsaturated.
Sterile and fat. Right, didn't they put on weight, too? Then they find that farmers could give the animals
But when they had a really high proportion, they became sterile, and the brain deteriorated.
Low energy.
Gonads in the brain were the first to deteriorate. That my professor, for example, identified that as an estrogen-promoting effect. That has continued to be confirmed, that estrogen increases the accumulation of polyunsaturated fats in the body and increases their activity at any one moment. And those fats simultaneously are increasing the effect of estrogen.
It's a vicious circle, huh?
Yeah, so the anti-estrogen effect was identical to the anti-PUFA effect, but both the seed oil industry and the estrogen industry found it very convenient to sell the idea that vitamin E is merely an antioxidant. So from the 1940s on, D-alpha tocopherol was identified as how to measure the value of vitamin E, because it was the most antioxidant. And so until just fairly recently, the only component that they measured was the alpha component, but it turns out that the gamma and others have very distinct, more important biological activities, including opposition to estrogen.
Cool. Excellent. All right. Good. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad we accidentally went there. That's a good breakdown of vitamin E and its use for sure. Okay. So you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor, KMUD, Garberville, 91.1 FM. From 7:30 until the end of the show, 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with questions related or unrelated to this month's continuing subject of ELF, extremely low frequency electromagnetic frequencies for healing. We have a bunch of abstracts here that I just want to get through with very specific known pathologies, just to get Dr. Pete's insight onto the activity of how these frequencies could have such a profound effect. I know we've mentioned Rife therapy in the past, and for want of not understanding it as well as I'd like to, and certainly want to believe Rife is a very a realistic approach. They certainly wanted to put the man in prison and take away all of his research material back when Raymond Rife was doing his research. So probably sounds like something they wanted to keep covered up. Not to get too conspiracy theorist about it. Anyway, the number is 707-923-3911. That's 707-923-3911. Dr. Raymond Peach joining us live on the air. So Dr. Pete, I just wanted to cover quickly. I don't want you getting bored with any of the subject matter. Sometimes I feel that we kind of drudge through some of the subjects you're not that interested in, perhaps, but without going too far in that direction. I looked at some articles last month for the extremely low-frequency electromagnetic spectrum and these electromagnetic fields on various pathologies. And we talked about the breast cancer one that showed definite, conclusive, positive benefits on breast cancer. I saw another one on... And it surprised me here because I know you've always mentioned high altitude being very good for people and the increased CO2 and it being part of a longevity formulation, if you like, high altitude, reducing stress, improving CO2 and improving longevity. But this was a test that was done on rats and they were, I guess, probably because the ulcers were simulated. They weren't actually... I don't know that. I think they were put in a hyperbaric chamber at, different partial pressure of oxygen to simulate higher altitude. But it was a high altitude stress ulcer healing in rats. So they gave these rats ulcers and they said that basically it was a hypoxia that was a part and parcel of the reason they got these ulcers and that it was fairly prevalent among people at high altitude. But do you have any idea first, I guess, about high altitude and ulcers, ulcer formation?
In that particular experiment, they were using restraint stress to produce the ulcers, and it happened to be combined with high altitude. So I don't think anything can be inferred from that study for humans.
So the stress was that they were restraining the rats?
If you're being suspended by your tail at high altitude...
It doesn't matter what altitude, you're going to be stressed out.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, anyway, all right, I just wanted to bring it out. They said that the low-frequency pulse electromagnetic fields could penetrate the stomach tissue, and they said they relieve the symptoms of the stomach ulcer and promote the regeneration of disturbed tissues. And they said that there was a clinical potential for this therapy for ulcer treatment. Okay, well, maybe not dwell on that one too much. And how about... this other study here it's entitled The Neuroprotective Effects of Low-Frequency Pulse Electromagnetic Fields in Ischemic Stroke. And this, again, I think is probably part and parcel of reperfusion or reducing the inflammatory sequelae that happens as a result of reperfusion after an ischemic event. I think about people that have heart attacks or coronary artery occlusion and heart attacks, and then benefiting from using hawthorn extract as an herbal medicine, and definitely has shown to reduce the ischemic, the size of the ischemic tissue post event, and promote healing.
They mentioned some of the inflammatory cytokines that are reduced by the treatment, and I think behind those particular protective changes, I think there's likely to be an increase of some of the basic defensive factors, such as heat shock protein.
Right. Okay.
Any kind of stress will bring on these stabilizing proteins, and I suspect that those are behind the various reductions of the inflammatory mediators. Another acute stress-induced protective factor is hypoxia-induced factor. That tends to come up at the same time as the heat shock proteins. And these help nerve cells, for example, to get through intense stress, which could be glucose deprivation or oxygen deprivation, either one.
Right. Because these, I have to be a little careful here when I look at these things and maybe take them out of context, but it's a little bit like inflammation, you know. It's not all bad. Inflammation is necessary to achieve certain end results, but obviously out of control inflammation is where we discuss inflammation as being negative. Okay. All right, let's see here. The other article I'm looking at, I think that's actually, we can probably skip this one. This is part and parcel of hypoxia-induced neuronal cell death. They'd mentioned here that there was various signal molecules that were involved in inflammation and various proteins that were secreted in response to inflammation, and that this pulse electromagnetic fields could mitigate the effects of this. I think I'm probably more interested in how the mechanism by which sound waves, and this is again, it kind of harks back to Rife therapy and disrupting cancer cells or indeed bacteria that Rife was experimenting with, and how the frequency, and I think we have to make analogies here to things like the Clifton suspension bridge swaying in the wind because of the harmonics that were produced by the wind blowing through the cabling, and how that frequency and that resonance became very disruptive and destructive and involved the bridge failing. But how these electromagnetic fields generate this disruptive event to become healing, you know, in terms of inflammation, and how that actually works. Do you have any insight into how that may actually, may actually be physically provable? I mean, I didn't really look at articles in terms of actually outlining the science of it. I was just very excited to see articles referring to people's disease, and especially bone treatment, bone remodeling. It was very conclusive. But how this activity could actually be a physical event?
The research of Robert Becker in biological electrical activity, he found that organisms are responsive to extremely weak electromagnetic signals, pulsations in the Earth's electromagnetic field. And older research in the 40s and 50s were finding that all sorts of organisms govern their metabolic rate by changes picked up from the electromagnetic field. Currently, the doctrine is that it's simply the light and dark changes that are cueing in the expression of certain genes appropriate for night or daytime. But in this older research, they would put the organism in sealed chambers out of sight of the outside changes of night and day. And some of the changes persisted even in holes in the ground, mine shafts. And plants, for example, that folded their petals during the night, some of these plants were taken down and they could still detect the changes of day and night until they were 60 feet below the surface. So there are some very penetrating electromagnetic fields that are crucially important for the cycles of plants. And the current dogma that it's nothing but daylight and nighttime are really trying to cover up that extreme sensitivity to weak fields, and how important it is that we're being bombarded with polluting electrical rhythms.
I'm going to ask you a little bit at the end. I've got one or two more abstracts I quickly want to look at, but I wanted to bring up the subject again, probably not for too long, but just to bring it up again, the whole 5G rollout of wireless internet that's taking over Europe, and it's obviously mounting opposition to it. But we'll go there in a little bit. I had another article here, and it caught my eye. It was for the treatment of Alzheimer's. And they were saying, and actually we got a little bit more specific here, and they were using 5 hertz and 90-minute cycles of 5 hertz, and they said that there was a definite improvement in cognitive ability. So for those Alzheimer's patients that are definitely declining cognitively, they saw a definite improvement using that. And they said during the abstract here, they did give a little bit more information. They were talking about tissue regeneration because of the ability to stimulate cell proliferation and immune functions via the specific heat shock protein family of heat shock proteins, and how that, I guess that probably plays into the neurofibrillary tangles and those kind of proteins that get deranged in Alzheimer's. So that was quite interesting. And then the last thing I wanted to cover did you want to say?
Oh no, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this next one again is just a another article here about bacterial infections that antibiotics are not able to treat anymore, so kind of a drug-resistant bacteria type scenario, where they've used electromagnetic fields and basically blocked things like tumor necrosis factor and transcription factor kappa beta, and they have basically been able to prevent the previously untreatable bacterial infection from getting out of control, and have actually been able to slow it down to a point where they're saying that this continuous exposure to pulse electromagnetic field at 5 hertz demonstrated significant changes in the downregulation of all those inflammatory cytokines that would be part and parcel of breaking down the cell and damaging the tissues and all the sequelae that inflammation brings with it and all the damage that it brings with it. So that's pretty cool.
So, Dr. Pete, would you recommend a practical approach to using these ELF and various pulsed EMF treatments?
I don't think there has been enough research. It's clear that these acute treatments can stimulate increased blood circulation and these defensive heat shock protein and hypoxia-induced factor, which are defensive, but the subtler things, long-range development course, I don't think there's enough information yet. And there's very little interest in following up research that was done 40 or 50 years ago on sound, for example. Dogma says that ordinary speaking frequency sound waves at that intensity couldn't possibly be interacting with cell chemistry, but several experiments have demonstrated that in fact just moderate volume music or speech vibrations affect the activity of muscle enzymes. ATPase, for example, was one that was tested, and the pitch A440 cycles was found to distinctly activate that particular enzyme. Each enzyme probably has its own responsive frequency, but that was contrary to standard biochemical cell function, and so it was totally neglected. ATP was found to respond to musical frequencies. That's another violation of standard physical chemical.
So we're supposed to speak to each other and hear voices and listen to music.
And speak kind words rather than shouting and screaming.
I know. Have they done tests on the various pitch of the voice?
The pitch affects enzyme activity.
Yeah, I can believe it completely without having to see any proof. It's just the concept of...
Well, just hearing a baby cry put anyone on edge.
Yeah, or people that get in road traffic, situations where they're just being loud and obnoxious, or, you know, all of that. I can't see that as being creative or healing in any way. It's always see it as being inflammatory and destructive. It's all part of that screaming and shouting cycle. Okay, so let's hold it there a second. You're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor, KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM. From now until 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with questions related or unrelated to this month's subject, or the closing subject here of electromagnetic fields and healing for different hertz time frequencies and different times. It's all out there on the internet if you want to look at it, folks. It's pretty exciting stuff, and there's 2019 and 2020 publications in, I'll say, quote-unquote, respected medical journals, but they are on PubMed, and you can see the various journals that have printed out the or put these abstracts out there for peer review, and they've actually shown up as articles. So the number here is 707-923-3911. Dr. Raymond Pete joining us, and we do have two callers on the line. So let's take this first caller. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from, and what's your question?
Hello, is this me?
Yeah, you're on the air. What's your question, and where are you from, caller?
I'm calling from Garberville, and I love the conversation. I'm wondering where it's going in general as far as how much individuals need to deal with and how much is actually medically relevant. I've been dealing with a chronic problem for a while that pushes me to my limits of mental ability because of past traumatic brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder what Dr. Pete has to say about organic damage to one's brain as far as any of this new research goes.
Dr. Pete, are you able to hear that clearly? I'm not getting it too clear here, but
I got the general idea about how
I can't hear you at all.
How much repair happens to organic brain damage?
Well, no, what I think he was asking is, this gentleman has organic brain damage, and he's asking how much relevance. Oh, sorry, we're having a lot of feedback from the caller.
The listener needs to turn his radio down when he speaks to
okay.
us. Yeah.
Okay, did you hear that? Listen, if you could...
I unfortunately couldn't hear the answer otherwise, so I had to get close to my radio.
Okay. Okay, so just once more, caller, you are suffering with traumatic brain injury, is that correct?
You sound so distant. I'm sorry.
I don't know what's
actually hear your response.
Yeah, I'm not too sure either.
Okay, but what I think he's asking is any of this EMF or ELF frequencies applicable to brain damage? Dr. Pete, and he wanted to know if you thought that could help his brain damage.
I think the random, the Wi-Fi.
No, I'm hearing all of you now. I'm nowhere near my radio. What I was possibly asking is, what advice would you have for somebody who realizes that there is damage? Hello?
I think when the brain has any inefficiency from whatever cause, it's more susceptible to interference from being around a broadcast station, for example. The healthier the brain is, the higher its threshold is to that kind of pollution, and the healing influence of the natural hormones proceeds at any age and in any starting condition. In traumatic brain injury, for example, they found that progesterone and vitamin D are both of them extremely helpful for facilitating repair, keeping down the inflammatory processes that would amount to something like a scar formation rather than a creation of new functioning nerve circuits.
If I might interject, just because I'm only barely understanding half of this because of the weird connection, I'm nowhere near my radio, but he seems to be saying something about progesterone and vitamin D as being helpful for brain function.
Yeah, that's correct. If you look online, you'll find lots of articles published by credible universities and scientists engaged in traumatic brain injury as a subject, specifically mentioning progesterone being very supportive and very anti-inflammatory.
So as a layman's question, where do you get progesterone? Is that something that would be prescribed, or is that something that one could find on their own? Or
you can find vitamin D and progesterone online.
What I heard was you can find vitamin D and progesterone online.
Yes. Correct. You can find both of those in a good health food store too. So
as a supplement,
There's nothing restricted about them.
And there might be three or four doctors in the country who are willing to prescribe those things, but it isn't necessary to have a prescription for them.
Yeah.
And also, Dr. Pete, you recommend...
Where does the progesterone come from?
It's usually from wild yam. It's synthesized from wild yam as a starting material.
It's the same molecule that your brain manufactures. The brain has the highest concentration of any tissue in the body of progesterone. It's an essential brain stabilizing molecule.
Okay, I think we should wrap this one up and move on to the next caller who's waiting. I appreciate your questions, and hopefully you were able to hear what we were trying to say. But next caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question? Are you there, caller? I see the lights are flashing. And
well, they are, first of all. But my main question is to all three of you, and I'll take my answer off the air. What do you know, if anything, about Dr. Hilda Clark's machine? I was thinking about that.
Right. In terms of Rife.
I'm sorry, we're having a lot of feedback here.
I think Hilda Clark's apparatus was a simple direct current device, which is in Robert Becker's research, he found that he could promote and normalize, promote nerve regeneration and establish normal function when nerves had been cut. But the use that Hilda Clark made of her direct current device, I don't think there was any research supporting the things she claimed for it.
There we go. Okay, let's take this next caller. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question?
Hi, yes, I'm calling from Washington, Tacoma region, and I'm calling on behalf of my husband since he wasn't able to call in due to work. He works in the medical field and was recently denied a influenza vaccination.
Okay.
Hi, Kate.
Okay, for some reason we're hearing the engineer talking to...
He works in the medical field, and he was recently denied an influenza vaccination exemption request by his hospital's immunization exemption appeals committee, despite the hospital having a written policy that allows employees with strongly held personal beliefs against vaccination to simply wear a mask instead of receiving the flu shot. My question to Ray Pete is, since these healthcare workers have a compulsory annual flu vaccination with toxic adjuvants, are there any changes that you would recommend to such people to their diet or supplementation regimen around the time of vaccination in order to mitigate the effects of adjuvants on systemic inflammation? For example, is it safe or effective to increase aspirin intake in order to minimize cytokine production?
Yeah, interesting. So good. Good question. We were going to cover adjuvants specifically in Dr. Pete's polio article. But Dr. Pete, would you speak to that? Did you hear that clearly?
Yeah, and the same things that will protect you against any injury from radiation to trauma or bacterial toxins, they can be used to protect against the aluminum particulate matter and the other random proteins that are contaminating vaccines. Aspirin is an important one. Progesterone and the youth-associated steroids, pregnenolone and DHEA, and progesterone in particular, are protective against the whole range of inflammatory processes.
Okay.
And I mean, what kind of doses would you recommend on aspirin, like a couple grams a day? And then you'd want to be taking vitamin K with that? Or would you think a low dose would be sufficient?
I think the day or two before and the following vaccination, I think probably 500 milligrams per day would be good.
And that would require some vitamin K as well, vitamin K2.
Vitamin K is another generally protective factor. Calcium, sodium, magnesium, these have a basic anti-inflammatory function when you get them through good foods.
Okay, so did that address your question, ma'am?
It definitely did. Thank you for your time, Dr. Repeat.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for
calling
in.
Thank you for your call.
Okay, so those people listening, this is Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM. From now until the end of the show at 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in, and that number is 707-923-3911. Once again, 707-923-3911. We do have another caller here lined up, so let's take this next caller. Call away from, what's your question?
Hi, I'm in New Harris, and this is Kim. I wanted to share that there is a site online, Dr. Pawluck, PAWLUK.com. Can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you. Dr. Pawluck, you said, yeah. Well, the engineer's talking to someone now, and apparently it's cutting into you, so I'm not sure what's happening.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you again. So just say that again.
Hello?
Yes, Kim, we can hear you now. The engineer is not speaking, so we can hear you.
Okay, it's interesting. I can't really hear you guys, but I wanted to tell you, drpawluck.com, P-A-W-L-U-C-L-U-K, Pawluck, he has done extensive research on pulsed electromagnetic fields, and his latest blog talks about traumatic brain injury. It was just posted February 10th, 2020.
Good.
You can sign up for his articles at drpawluck.com.
Well, good. Well, thank you for sharing that. It's quite very timely.
Bye-bye.
Well, hopefully the first caller can...
Yeah, hopefully the first caller
can
hear it.
Go online and look up Dr. Pawluck.
Okay, so for all of those of you who are listening, I'm very sorry about the trouble with feedback and not hearing us properly. I know it has been a question in the past, and some people have been pretty vociferous about it. Okay, so let's take this next caller. Caller, you're on the airway from, and what's your question?
Hello, how are you guys?
Doing good. How are you? What's your question? Where are you from?
Hello?
Hi.
Here we go again.
Hello, caller. We can hear you.
How are you folks doing?
Good. What's your question?
I have a question. First, I just want to say, have you guys ever heard of Dharma Singh Khalsa, MD?
No.
He has I can't really hear you, but he has a book called Food is Medicine, and which I haven't read yet, and I've read a little bit as Meditation as Medicine. Hello?
Hi. We can still hear you.
Okay.
So... what's your question?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, we heard part of your...
Okay, yeah, somebody just told me I was going to be next. The Dharma Singh Khalsa, MD, he talks about how when you meditate and your tongue hits the roof of your mouth, it releases amino acids to your brain and helps rebuild your cells, or releases amino acids from your brain. And it's been real helpful for me for healing bone injuries. But the question I have is, how does spices, how do spices help our digestive system? Like, do they help our cells take in nutrients and stuff like that? I could take my answer off the line. Thank you.
Okay. I think, Dr. Pete, you want to answer that probably with a lots of spices are allergenic type response. But what do you think about spices and nutrient uptake?
The idea that anything stimulating your appetite, your nerves, your brain is in control of your digestive system, that was Pavlov's basic research, seeing how the brain manages the whole digestive process. And if you have negative thoughts, anxiety, you'll have digestive problems. The spices that stimulate salivation, for example, will stimulate secretion in your stomach and small intestine and make everything digest optimally. But some spices happen to be allergenic for some people, so you have to be cautious.
Well, you have to experiment and find out. And also, just like chili or capsicum, that increases blood flow, so that can improve digestion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, but in general, the caller was asking about spices as aids to nutrient absorption, and I think what you've mentioned about people that have malabsorption syndrome, for example, is when they're not actually producing enough bile from the liver, or they're not stimulated to release, pepsin or any of these other digestive enzymes. There are certainly digestive enzymes that can work, but obviously there's plenty of herbs that do stimulate secretion of salivary enzymes as well as digestive enzymes and increase hydrochloric acid, and that is all part and parcel of nutrient absorption. And a lot of these would be termed spices, so things that would be aperitifs, things like cinnamon, ginger, cloves. These are definite spices, but I also recognize that there are people that are definitely sensitive to those, and they can cause other symptoms. But
well, bitter herbs are very useful at increasing the digestion, the digestive enzymes, and increasing absorption of nutrients and increasing stomach acid. And of course, people that are low thyroid will have a decrease in all of the enzymes and the digestive secretions needed for absorbing nutrition.
The bitters work on multiple levels, stimulating your nerves. Right. And some of them actually improve mitochondrial energy production. Some of them have systemic sedative and stabilizing effects. They can be very important to your general health.
Yeah, good. Things like gentian, wormwood, any of the...
We've started giving our daughter century.
Yes,
century. Which is
Centauri.
A little bitter. It's a little clover.
Yeah. All right, excellent. There is one more caller. Let's take this next caller. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question?
Yeah, my question relates to the topic of the day. Dr. P, were you referring in your earlier discussion on energy to scalar energy, which ultimately can be, it doesn't really degrade. It's been around since, I guess, Tesla, developed it. Essentially also known as zero-point energy, and the health benefits, I guess, as I understand it, in a nutshell, are that it enables the cells to operate at the appropriate frequencies, which I guess are in the 70 to 90 millivolt range. Is that what you were referring to earlier?
No. Earlier we were.
I'm asking Dr. P.
Oh.
Oh. Well, the stabilizing hormones and the nutrients and physical factors, thyroid hormone, progesterone, pregnenolone, carbon dioxide, for example, all tend to stabilize around the 70 to 90 millivolt resting potential. But the high energy state really is a quiescent state, so that the voltage is not active. It's a quiescent.
My second question. No, yeah, my, my sec. My other question relates to Dr. Ling, I guess, who died last year, and I heard you speaking about him earlier. But I guess his AIH, the hypothesis...
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Hello, can you hear me?
Up to Ling's association induction hypothesis.
Yeah, sorry. So essentially, like a red blood cell has 300 million of these NPUs, so within one red blood cell. So essentially, are we talking about health that must be at some point analyzed not at the cellular level, but at the NPU level?
The cell in Ling's view is a unified phase. Doesn't have the properties of a random solution, but a single unified functional sort of a personality that goes through phasic changes that organize its function.
Where did we get that? All right, I think we've got some real problems here. Let's just call this good for the evening. It's 5 to 8. I've got a quick question I wanted to ask Dr. Pete. Dr. Pete, I had somebody send an email in who was concerned with the fact that most cattle, most milk dairy cattle, are kept in a permanently pregnant state, and he was wondering what you thought perhaps was the potential estrogen load of milk. I don't know if it's that relevant, but what do you think about milk and cows that are constantly in estrus?
There is an anti-milk lobby that makes a lot of publicity, and that's one of their current ploys to direct people away from milk. But if you look at the consumption of milk over the last 50 years, yeah, there's a tremendous decrease, yeah, even in children.
Yeah.
More and more they're shifting to,
yep,
so-called
nut milk,
vegetable-based,
yep,
milk substitute.
Mm-hmm.
And during this time, looking at the population, you see a tremendous increase in premature puberty in girls,
mm-hmm,
and a great increase in gynecomastia, the development of,
right,
breasts, in boys and men.
Yep.
So as the milk consumption decreases, estrogenicity in our,
yeah,
and the cows aren't kept in constant pregnancy, because I have a dairy farmer friend, and
he's saying that basically they're pregnant, they're made pregnant, they deliver the cow, a baby calf, and then obviously they're producing the milk, but then they're automatically made pregnant again, essentially.
No, they get a drying off period.
Well,
one of the reasons milk tends to have an overall protective effect against estrogen is that the estrogens that are in milk are in a detoxified form. Estrone sulfate, for example, is the least harmless, mm-hmm, form of estrogen, not at all comparable to the estrogens that are in the soy milk substitute.
Right, exactly. Okay, well, let's hold it there, Dr. Pete, because we've only got a minute and a half before the top of the hour. Thank you very much for joining us again. I'm sorry about the difficulty with the engineering and the sound and the feedback and everything else. So for those people who've tuned in and want to know more about Dr. Pete, he can be reached at www.raypete.com, R-A-Y-P-E-A-T.com. He's got lots of articles fully referenced about many different pathologies, most of which people are going to look there will find certainly information relevant to what they're searching for. And then also he's written some books, and obviously he's lectured fairly widely, but information is quite hard to find out about Dr. P, because I think he ends up doing a lot of his own research and doesn't really get around like he used to. But anyway, thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Pete. For those people who want to find out any more about us, our business web address is westernbotanicalmedicine.com. My wife and I both produce medicinal herb extracts with GMP registered and inspected and audited and all that good stuff. And,
and certified organic.
Certified organic, yeah. I've been doing it over 20 years too. So for those people who have listened to the show and called in, thanks for your questions. Until March of next, third Friday of next month in March, good night.
Good night. Thank you for listening.